This is a podcast from policyreview.tv.
Let's take some questions. I've got, as always, I'll take my chairman's prerogative and kick off with a couple. A couple of ones I wanted to pick out. One is, which sectors generally, you mentioned obviously children's and adult services, and I know you're doing a lot at Suffolk on that, but you know, which sectors in particular are kind of, if you like, ripe for social enterprise mutuals? Some of them are back office, some of them are front. And the other question was the issue which you touched on about change of culture, and also the fact that inevitably, as you've got a more entrepreneurial culture, that there's an impact on particularly senior salaries. If you need to get good financial directors, you've got to start paying for them. In turn, what impact does that have on the structure of the organisation and the costs? And also, what about the lenders? Are the lenders going to start stipulating that actually your organisation is a bit flabby at the moment, so we'll lend you the money, but we expect, you know, X, Y, and Z. So can I sort of throw that out to the panel?
I'll have a crack at where I think the action is. In councils, most of our money, and Jeff will corroborate this, is in, but we spend it on children's services and adult services. The rest of it is small beer by comparison. Children's services, certainly in my part of the world, are mainly run by us, the council. Adult services, I think, are 78% out already. And there's still a residual bulk of, you know, £20-30 million worth, but nothing like what it was 20, 25 years ago. So I think human services, social services for adults and children are big ones within councils. I think within health, I think it's mainly in the non-acute side, because most acutes are now becoming or are already foundation trusts, which are another thing altogether. I can't see it as much there, but there's still an awful lot of the NHS outside the acute sector which could be doing this. But that's my thought on that. I'll just give someone else some chance to say something, though.
Julie?
I mean, I completely agree with who, where it's sort of ripe and where we see a lot of activity. I mean, Right to Request has focused on some organizations, but I think that there's quite a few other people that maybe got the idea and didn't get a chance to pursue it before Right to Request closed, which was in the autumn in September of 2010. So I think that a lot more will have the opportunity through Right to Provide. And I think a lot of it, from what I've seen, I mean, both for big provider arms, but also individual services, a lot of it comes from the staff. I mean, if staff want to do this, if they want to run it themselves and take it on themselves, that is the biggest thing, I think, to make it successful. I know it was mentioned earlier, the difference between top-down and bottom-up, but I'm a big believer in bottom-up. Yes, it may be an impetus that, you know, top-down may give them an idea, but I think it has to be taken on by those who want to do it. In terms of sort of the question around getting good management and paying for that and lenders being specific around governance, I mean, certainly CEIF has done that. When CEIF has made investments into organizations where they felt that the governance was a bit weak, part of the investment committee criteria has been that certain things happen. It could be that there's a certain number of non-exec directors versus executive directors, because sometimes it's proposed to have a number of executive directors and not as many non-executive. And actually, from a governance perspective, that was not deemed to be as good of an idea. It's also been, specifically, they will look at management committee backgrounds and skills and say, well, it does look like you're lacking in, let's say, finance, and we would expect a finance manager or senior person to be hired or represented better within the board. So it could be, you know, in one or the other. In terms of the costs associated with those, I mean, I'm a big believer. I worked in the nonprofit world, and I've worked in the for-profit world, now in the public world. I mean, I find it very hard to, you know, when I see comments about, you know, X percent on admin or X percent on overheads, and that's all it should be. And I think it's a really unfair situation, because I think good expertise does cost a decent amount of money. It doesn't need to be obscene. But I think that that should be recognized. And I think that, as a whole, the third sector does have a ways to go on that in terms of recognizing and not being afraid to say that good management and good governance does cost a reasonable amount of money. And I think, you know, there's always definitions around what is reasonable, and I think that's really hard. And I think it's made harder by organizations who may have lots of funding behind them or have a very good leader who may have made their money. You hear it all the time, I made my money doing this, and now I've decided to do something really good with my life. And I think that's really hard for those who are trying to make a living, but also doing good at the same time. And I think it's trying to balance that, which is really difficult to do.
Jane or Ben, you had a...
Just a minor point on the issue of culture that you mentioned there. And I think just with my area of expertise around assets and in my previous working life, I worked for a company that grew out of the public sector. And I think that the physical environment in which you work and which you're delivering your service from really does impact on the staff. And if you feel you've got some ownership in the delivery, then yes, you're going to be looking at, we mentioned utilisation levels, different ways of working. It's imposed from the top in some grotty old building when you've still got the old workstations and all these piles of rubbish everywhere. I think it really can have a significant impact on staff motivation as well.
Okay. Ben, do you want to add anything?
In terms of areas, I think those where there's a high degree of relatively kind of personal care is important. I mean, you know, mentioned Hackney Community Transport is actually very unusual, I think, as a successful social enterprise, because it's about, you know, buses and infrastructure to an extent. I think it's best when you can kind of galvanise the staff who need to have quite a lot of trust and buy in to what's happening. I think in terms of investment, one of the things which I think is really important on investors is understanding how the business is going on a sort of month-by-month basis or quarter-by-quarter basis, rather than just a sort of, we'll see what happened a couple of years later. And that might require quite a shift in approach of management information systems, possibly junking some, but investing a lot more in others that are giving you a really good mechanism for managing the business.
Okay, thanks. Any comments or questions? A little at the back. Just say where you're from, please.
Yes, it's Mark Johnson, TPP Law. A couple of questions, if I may. The first one to Ben around investment models. One thing that's not really been talked about is the idea of retail investors who might have a bit of discretionary savings of a few hundred pounds to put into a project where they could earn a modest return, given that bank rates are so low at the moment. Is there any work going on there to try and harness that class of investor? And the second point was one for Craig around competition and diversity driving up standards. Are you hopeful that the current pause on the health and social care bill will be sorted out, or does it fill you with despair that competition may be removed and there may be more protected monopolies in the NHS and social care?
Ben, you kick off.
Yeah, as I said, I would see individual investors as coming after foundations, and already seeing and certainly being more interested than, say, pension funds or others, because they feel they've got the discretion to blend some social impact and financial return. The distribution of this can be quite challenging. And that's why, I mean, we are looking at funds which might be targeted not at people who've got a few hundred pounds, but a few thousand pounds to invest, really being distributed through sort of IFA networks. Some of the tax breaks which are being used and have recently been increased in the budget, such as VC, Venture Capital Trust funds, which have got pretty good tax incentives, which were designed really for investment in small tech startups and other commercial startups, and could be applied to the social sector as well. And that's certainly the type of funding we're looking to consider establishing.
Okay, I've had a chance to think about my answer now. Basically, what I feel about this is it's a mixture of the two thoughts, really. Firstly, we definitely need competition within all public services, no doubt about that, and it would be disappointing to see amendment of this bill eliminate competition. Equally, however, we need a market which is quite carefully developed and managed. We can't be naive about the fact that highly capitalised organisations can afford to take a 10-year view of a public sector market and go in extremely good value, you know, at the beginning and establish a very dominant position early and so on. So we have to manage the market to encourage diversity of supply. You know, some parts of the states do actually require the social sector, as we call it, to be guaranteed 25% of market share in government contracts in some areas, just in order to enable that, you know, that sector to have a role. So we do need some market management, and it does need to be, it can't be a free for all, I feel, because we'll just find ourselves very quickly overwhelmed by forces that are bigger than we know how to deal with. We also have to be very, very aware, I believe, of we have to take a whole system view of some parts of health. You can't simply take out certain services and provide them privately, leaving an unviable rump to be delivered by the public sector. So some very careful market management has to be done, but you can have a much, much more competitive system than we have now, notwithstanding that. That's my view. So yeah, so we'll see what happens, eh?
Hi, Claire Delaney from Place Group. It's for you, Craig, actually. Two questions. Navigo, from start to finish, how long did that take?
Oh, gosh. We weren't involved at the start. Julie, you might know this. Yeah.
I probably do actually even have the exact date. Their right to request was approved, you said, in December, was the business plan. And I think that their expression of interest, they came onto the radar for us at CIF probably less than a year ago. So probably summer, actually it might have been last summer that they would have their expression of interest done and then develop their business plan probably over a six-month period. So probably last summer till December and then launched in April.
So just under a year.
Okay, that's great. And I'm just curious with regard to the gap funding that was in Julie's presentation and, you know, access to it, especially in the planning of the business cases for people that want to spin out. Craig, is your organisation supporting organisations that want to spin out, and are you then helping them getting the gap funding, which they then presumably spend on you? Does that make sense? Sorry.
The answer, yeah, basically. And obviously, there's a number of organisations that they're given. I think the department now actually provides quite a decent list of you know, respectable advisors to work with them. But yeah, there is a need, I think, for advice of different kinds. The reason we came along, I think, was that I noticed that quite a few organisations were having to go out and find themselves a range of support services needed, you know, from lawyers to accountants right through to project managers, and often going out in a marketplace that they didn't understand and therefore paying maybe what they shouldn't be paying and struggling to coordinate the resulting, you know, blend of professionals working with them. So we the idea of this really was to say, well, come to us, we'll get all that for you and we'll coordinate it and work with you on it and get it cheaper than you would have got it. So that's the idea.
And you're helping them access the money as well?
Sorry?
And you're helping them access the money as well?
Well, as much as we can, yeah. We will, yeah.
In terms of accessing CIF, I mean, the way that it works is that for those that are going through the spin-out phase need to come through local partnerships, and right now that would be me, and then I work with them to determine exactly what they need, and then also given the constraints around CIF, whatever the funding, where it can go. So we've just had financial year end March 31. We've had the minimum $10 million announced. But to be very honest, we do not know what the priorities are for that $10 million. Until we do, we cannot develop what we call the investment plan, which means we cannot start committing that money. We expect that to take until early May. Well, sometime in May. We're debating when that's going to be. But then at that point, we can work with organizations to actually put the applications to CIF for funding. When organizations come to us, we do have a signposting list because we need to be fair in terms of competition. And we do recommend that organizations talk to at least a few and follow procurement policies within their own local authority or PCT to determine how they want to go about finding the right people to work with. Yes, Craig's organization is on there, so are others, and it is important for our perspective that they are comfortable with whomever they want to work with, and they feel they're going to get the value for money that they need to get. yes, we've got ideas as to what it would might cost, but we're not the ones to actually then go back and negotiate directly with Craig. It would be the organizations that need to do that, and they can access the funding through us to enable them to do that.
Thank you. Okay, great. Well, I think on that note, we'll take a short break. I'd like to thank Craig, Jane, Julie, and Ben very much for your presentations.